Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How would the modern world look if the United States had not been such a dominant force in global politics, economics, and peacekeeping since the end of the Second World War? While some analysts predict the eventual or even imminent end of America's influence, my guest today would argue the world can scarcely afford that right now, and that the troubling sense that America is already in decline is a factor of a misunderstanding of our history over the past several decades. Robert Kagan is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and columnist for The Washington Post. He writes about all this in his new book, The World America Made. Bob, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
So you were adamant here that the United States is not in or approaching a period of great decline. Why do so many people perceive that that is, in fact, the case?
Well, obviously, some of it is just the reaction to the fact that we've been in a recession for several years. That always makes people depressed. And there's no question that we've got serious challenges and economic problems, not the least of which is our fiscal deficit. People, I think, are apprehensive about the rise of China and some other powers. But I think that, you know, if you look at the issues, the sort of measures of power in a sober fashion, you see really that the United States is not less powerful than it's been in the past. And again, as you've mentioned, I think that people have a very rosy view of how the United States used to be able to order everyone around, and now we can't. But of course, that never really was the case.
Yeah, we've always had plenty of pushback from countries that have different ideas than we do.
Absolutely. I mean, if you go through every decade, beginning in the first decade after World War II, there were a number of major strategic setbacks. We all remember the successes in Europe and the formation of NATO and things like that, but there was also the Chinese Revolution in 1949, the Korean War, which was pretty much brought on by the Chinese Revolution in 1950, the Soviets getting a hydrogen bomb. These at the time were considered tremendous strategic setbacks, real instances of the limitation of American power. And then we could go on through the Vietnam War, the 1970s, gas oil crisis, the fall of the Shah of Iran, and the victory of the Iranian Revolution. It's just a mistake to believe that we used to be able to get our way all the time.
And in fact, you're not arguing that it would be best if we were absolutely omnipotent.
No, I think that, you know, first of all, that's impossible. But second of all, I think one of the great things about the way the United States has behaved in the world, despite all of our mistakes, and we've made many mistakes, and we've, you know, certainly annoyed many people around the world, is that by and large, though, most nations around the world know that we're not an inherently aggressive power, know that we're not trying to expand territory anymore. We did in the 19th century, but we're not doing that anymore. And that fundamentally our desire, Americans' desire is not to get too involved in the world, even though we are heavily involved.
What do you see as the most significant danger in incorrectly assuming, if it is incorrectly, that we've come to the end of the era of U.S. dominance?
Well, my concern, and one of the reasons I wrote the book, is that you know, if you start believing that decline is inevitable, then we can start trying to so-called manage decline. I know some people thought that that's what Barack Obama came in to do, was sort of manage American decline. And if you really do pursue that kind of approach, begin to pull in inward, begin to focus only on issues within our borders and cease playing the role we played in the world, then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, and then your fear of decline actually produces decline.
And there's been much talk about the fact that the President's State of the Union address appeared to have referred to the material in this book. Do you know for a fact that he's read it, and have you spoken with him about it?
I haven't spoken with him. I've spoken to some of his top advisors, and I do actually know that he's read it because he went through an essay that was extracted from the book and appeared in the New Republic. He sort of went through it with a bunch of TV journalists, sort of paragraph by paragraph. So I'm aware that he has read it. I'm glad he was interested in the arguments. And I have talked to several of his advisors about it.
Let's talk about this. If the United States were to step aside, you are not convinced there is another democracy on the planet that is both willing and able to step in and fill the void that we would leave.
Yes, I think that, you know, sometimes people get a little bit hopeful and complacent about the notion that the United States does weaken, that there'll be somebody else to step in and play the role the United States has been playing since the end of World War II. I really don't see such a power on the horizon. Europe is a great collection of democracies. I think the European Union will probably survive, but Europe doesn't wield the kind of influence and power in the world that the United States has. And the rest of the rising powers that people talk about, China, China certainly doesn't have the same goals that Americans have, doesn't have a stake in a democratic world. I'm not even sure it has a stake in a liberal international economic order, and so cannot be expected to uphold such a world. And other powers like Brazil and India that are rising, I just don't think they are ready or interested in taking on these global responsibilities.
Of course, as you know, there are other people who argue that we have reached a point in sort of human societal evolution where it's like teaching a child to ride a bike. The United States is the parent holding on to the back of that seat, and maybe we can just let go and things would keep going the way they have.
Yeah, I know. There are a lot of people who think that. I must say that history gives reason to precaution about that. We have seen previous periods that looked like they were shaping up, as you just suggested. At the end of the 19th century, there was an increase in the number of democracies in around the world, a small number, but it was still a substantial increase at the time. The global economy was expanding. Nations were becoming more interdependent. They had what they didn't call globalization, but we would call globalization, a revolution in communications and transportation. And it was all destroyed in World War I. And then we saw, a backsliding of democracies. There were only 10 on the eve of World War II. We saw the explosion of the liberal economic order, which had been so successful, with nations turning toward protectionism and isolationism. And so these orders that I think it's too easy to take for granted, they really depend on the behavior of the great powers who have an interest in them, upholding them. And when those powers fall or weaken, you get a different kind of international order.
And we can, in fact, look to other periods in history when we were not the dominant power, but there was one clear power in the world.
Sure. I mean, much of the kind of world order that we appreciate today, there was the beginnings of that in the 19th century when Britain was the dominant power. Its navy was dominant, and it upheld an international economic system from which the United States benefited tremendously. And the tragedy came after World War I, when Britain was no longer able to uphold that kind of world order. And really, at that point, the baton should have been passed to the United States, but the American people at that time didn't want that responsibility, and as a result, that whole world order collapsed.
So I want to talk specifically about your title, The World America Made. What are some of the conditions, positive conditions, that exist in the world today as a direct or indirect result of U.S. policies and power?
Well, there are three basic elements of our world order, whatever you want to call it. One is an enormous spread in the number of democracies. As I said, at the dawn of World War II, there were 10 democracies in the world. Today, there are 115, which is historically unprecedented, obviously. We've never had a democratic age like this. And, of course, the United States has not always supported democracy. We have supported dictatorships. We have even overthrown democracies over the years. But the overall thrust of American policy and just the existence of the United States, I think, is very responsible for the number of democracies that have spread around the world and the fact that they have been able to sustain themselves, often with American support. Another element that I would point to is the absence of great power conflict, absence of war among the really big powers in the world. Throughout human history, great power conflict was a constant. It was a constant in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, and certainly in the first half of the 21st century. But the overwhelming power of the United States has really discouraged great power conflict for the past six decades and more. And I think that's another thing that we take for granted. It doesn't have to be that way.
When you talk about great power conflict, that is really an interesting point and something that we all benefit from. Is that also, though, a factor of the reality that simply we're beyond the point at which there is much disputed territory? There are pockets here and there, but there aren't, very few countries have designs on invading another and taking over vast amounts of land.
Well, I think I'm not sure. I mean, I think that to some extent that's true, but the argument that nations don't need territory anymore, they just need markets or they just need innovation. I mean, that argument was actually also made prior to World War I, when people thought that nations couldn't possibly benefit from attacking each other. Britain and Germany were their number one trading, were each other's number one trading partners. How could they benefit from a war? And yet they did go to war. I think if you look around the world today, you could see many areas where territorial disputes could lead to significant conflict, if the United States was no longer generally able to keep the peace. Taiwan is one obvious example. The South China Sea is an example. Obviously, there are territorial disputes in the Middle East, which could easily lead to war, whether it's Israel and Palestine. Other borders are insecure and undefined. So I think that you can't be confident that the cause of war has really disappeared. And I think, again, we shouldn't take for granted that one reason nations don't act in the way that they used to is because the one predominant power has made that kind of behavior costly.
And of course, there is also our influence on the world economy, and that can go both ways, as we know. But talk about what makes you think that it's still an advantage to the world.
American power?
American power in terms of its influence on the global economy.
On the global economy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, you know, right now it doesn't seem like it is. And obviously, the United States is responsible in some part for the economic calamity that has befallen the world. And I think the rest of the world understands that. But there is a general kind of international economic order that the United States has been the primary supporter of. And that is a fundamentally open, free trading, free market system, from which, ironically, China has been a great beneficiary. India has been a great beneficiary. A lot of these rising powers like Brazil and Turkey have been great beneficiaries. But the question is, could they, without the United States, uphold that order by themselves? And I think my answer is no. They don't have the capacity. They don't have the ability to keep the sea lines of communication open, which is something the United States Navy does everywhere around the world. So I think that if you really did see a decline in American influence, you might well see a decline in this international economic order, even though so many have benefited from it.
Do you think the yuan or any other currency is truly a threat to the dominance of the U.S. dollar as the global currency?
Well, I'm not an economist, so I'm not sure I'm equipped to answer that question. You know, I think that clearly China's overall economic influence is increasing. Whether it is going to be a currency that competes with the United States depends on whether people continue to consider the United States the safest investment. And one of the interesting things that we've seen, even during the recession, is that you know, the United States currency still is seen as the most stable currency that people want to be investing in. So, I mean, I can't foresee what will happen 20, 30 years from now, but right now I would say the dollar seems to be still pretty steady.
And even if, as predicted, the size of the Chinese economy eclipses that of the United States, you would remind us to look at GDP. Or rather, per capita GDP.
Exactly. I think that's an interesting question. I mean, obviously, the size of the Chinese overall GDP is very much related to the fact that they have over 1 billion people in the country. But the per capita GDP puts China really at quite a low level in terms of income compared to other nations in the world. The United States and European nations, for instance, have per capita GDP of over $40,000 a year. China's per capita GDP is roughly around $4,000 a year, which is about the size, which is about the level of Angola. And even 20 years from now, when China's economy will have grown, China will become a little bit richer. It'll still be a fraction of where the United States and the other richer countries are, and China's per capita GDP will be about where Greece is today. So it'll be an interesting phenomenon, which I think is almost unprecedented, of the world's largest economy, nevertheless not being by any means the world's richest economy.
Robert Kagan is my guest. He's senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a columnist for The Washington Post. His new book is called The World America Made. If you'd like to join the conversation, we have lines open now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Robert Kagan. He's senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a columnist for the Washington Post. His latest book is called The World America Made. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. How concerned should we be, Bob, about the amount of U.S. debt held by Chinese creditors?
Well, I think we should be worried about the amount of the U.S. debt. I'm not so sure how worried we should be about the fact that the Chinese hold a lot of that debt. Mm-hmm. Again, I'm not an economist, but I've often heard the old line that if you owe the bank $10, the bank, you're in trouble, but if you owe the bank $10 million, the bank's in trouble. And I'm not sure what benefit the Chinese get from holding this debt. I'm quite confident they would never decide simply to dump it as some way of attacking the United States, because what would they do with the money? They depend heavily on the success of the American economy. The Chinese economy is absolutely intertwined with our economy, so I don't really see what leverage it gets them, other than perhaps a psychological leverage. I know that Secretary of State Hillary Clinton once commented on how difficult it is to say no to your banker, but I don't think we necessarily need to feel that way.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones now to Robert in Fort Worth. Hello, Robert.
Good afternoon. This is a great subject. Good afternoon, Mr. Kagan.
Hi.
This, to me, I get very passionate when I hear about the power we once held in throughout the world. And one aspect, I think, is manufacturing. We have sent – I'm a victim of outsourcing. When I was a technical writer, my job was outsourced twice, and it's frustrating. However, manufacturing. I grew up in New Jersey. I worked in factories, and factories offered many jobs to many people, and it allowed people to move on to another stage in their life. I get really annoyed at the current candidates running for political office, Republican political office, saying that they're going to help jobs, help create jobs and revive the manufacturing sector. It's a really tough, hard. It is tough for me to try to understand that. So I do think that manufacturing is a vital. Vital part of our economy, but also too, I tried to look on. Tried to do some little research on this last night. Profit sharing. Do corporations offer profit sharing? I know my wife works for a huge bank, probably the biggest bank in the world, and they offer her. They gave her two bonuses.
Well,
recently,
Robert, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I think you're taking us a little bit off topic. Did you want to talk a bit about the role of the United States in the world? Maybe that's where you're leading with your question.
Well, yeah, the role of manufacturing. I think we've really sent it all away. And do you think we can bring it back? Let me ask you that. Do you think we can bring it back?
Well, I don't know whether we can bring it back in quite the way it was. I mean, our economy, the American economy, is evolving and really has been evolving, you know, throughout its history. There was a time when, you know, more than half of Americans were employed on farms, but then came manufacturing. Clearly, we're moving into an age where more manufacturing is done by robots, which is bad for employment in manufacturing. But I also think that the United States, as a nation, is poised to do very well in the global economy of the future, because that economy is increasingly based on information and networking, and the United States, the American people, are particularly adept at that. In fact, they really do lead the world, including in terms of innovations in that area. So, but I don't think we're going to have, you know, the same economy that we've had in the past, and that means there's going to be very painful dislocation, which is why I think, you know, the smartest people talk about how do you retrain people, how do you compensate for the fact that we're losing manufacturing jobs, partly just because of the changing nature of the economy.
Is it safe to assume that the developing economies that are are gaining some ground, having brought in these manufacturing jobs, are hoping to evolve to the point at which they will have a knowledge-based economy?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you talk to these nations are all trying to move up what economists call the value chain. They may start by producing cheap goods, but then they gradually want to move up the ladder and start producing more and more sophisticated goods. Now, you know, this caused a problem in the case of China because, as many American businesses find, they want American technology. They invite businesses in. They basically steal the technology, and then they make it no longer possible for the businesses to exist. So that's a big issue, which I think both the administration and Republican candidates have been talking about. But there's no question everybody wants to move up in the direction of where we are. And I think that, you know, we need to remember that we are at the forefront of that kind of economy.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. Next on the line, we have David in California. Hey, David.
Hey, greetings. You know, I wanted to ask you about the concept of all the way back to 1776, we were fighting the Tories, and we pretty well whipped them. But many Tories stayed in power, and now are the Tories basically setting the ratings for the Republics? So in other words, if you look at Solomon Brothers, they got busted back in Ronald Reagan's day because they were doing fake bidding on the Treasury notes. And Enron was essentially the ability to have an international corporation act as a colony against regions of the country. And so as soon as you paid your electric bill, that money was sucked out of town and went to an offshore bank where it never paid taxes and never provided any income stream for the region anymore. So the idea that we've been allowing the Tories to set up financial institutions which are nothing more than colonies, and in the name of corporations, they're recolonizing the world and dividing everybody, and then when everyone's divided, they set up ratings agencies to give us higher and higher interest rates.
What do you think about all that, Bob?
Well, I'm not sure that it's fair to the Tories back in the revolutionary period. I mean, they were called Tories because they were pro-England, not because they were big capitalists. And actually, I would say that it was the revolutionaries, people like Alexander Hamilton and others, who kind of invented at least the early stages of modern American capitalism. But, you know, one thing we know for sure is that capitalism is a flawed activity that invites people who are trying to cut corners, trying to find some way to game the system, with bad consequences for everybody. We've seen this at several periods throughout our history. In fact, it's almost every 40 years that the system comes crashing down. There was a crash in the 1890s. There was a crash, obviously, the Great Depression in the 1930s. The 1970s were disastrous from an economic point of view, and now we've just 40 years later had this crisis. And so there's no question that capitalism goes through these periods. The other part of it, though, is that it also comes out of them. And I found it interesting, looking back on that history, that in the next decade, after each one of those terrible crises, the United States actually came roaring back, both as an economy and as a global power.
You know, David's question does also raise the additional question of you know, when we think about U.S. power, I think our minds go to that which is wielded by the government, by the military. What amount of American power today is, in fact, wielded by U.S. corporations?
Well, obviously, some of it, but I don't, you know, when you think about power, you think about the national wealth, the capacity to build a military that is strong enough, but also the influence that the national economy wields in the international system, and certainly corporations are part of that. You think about cultural influence, which corporations can be. I mean, corporations like Coca-Cola and McDonald's. But at the end of the day, I think that the more important national power has to do with the values of the nation and the ability of the nation to support those values both at home and overseas. I think that's more important than what the corporate interests are.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Fred in McKinney. Hello, Fred.
Hi. Interesting topic. My question is, does the author think considering our military capabilities and other countries throughout history with very capable militaries, looking at 9/11 and how had the terrorists instead attacked, say, Russia or China in two major cities and a military headquarters, wouldn't their responses have been a lot more, well, harsh than ours were with Afghanistan and the Taliban?
Well, it's possible. It depends on where it is. I mean, I think that you're right to point out that, you know, the United States actually responded, you know, in a clear and precise fashion in the case of Afghanistan. On the other hand, it also had the capacity to move great quantities of forces and firepower very far from its home. And that's one thing that I think both Russia and China have a great difficulty doing. I mean, it is really the unique aspect of American power is the ability to project force, project significant and decisive force thousands of miles away. But I don't think you're wrong to assume that any country, and particularly those great powers, would not have responded very angrily and with significant destruction in response to an attack like that.
What should we read in the buildup of naval power that we've seen in the past couple of years from China and India both?
Well, together they are in competition. I mean, mm-hmm. they are both basically trying to either dominate or prevent the other power from dominating in the Indian Ocean and now increasingly in the area of the South China Sea. The Indian naval buildup is a direct response to China's naval buildup. China's naval buildup, on the other hand, is really an effort by China to, I think, from the Chinese point of view, return to their historical position as the dominant power in East Asia. As China's wealth grows, their desire to be the hegemonic power in the region, their claims in the South China Sea, for instance, harken back to 1,000 years ago. When China was the dominant power. And, of course, China's economic interests have become global. And in fairness, much like the United States at the end of the 19th century, as your economic interests become global, your desire to protect those interests with your own forces arises. Up until recently, the United States has been the preserver and protector of China's economic interests globally. It's not surprising that China doesn't want to continue to rely on the United States.
For better or for worse, depending on who you talk to and what you're talking about, America has been the police force for the planet for some time now. Can we continue to serve in that capacity given the kinds of military spending cuts that are on the table now?
Well, I think that we can unless we choose not to. And I think that the desire of people to focus on military spending as some kind of answer to our fiscal crisis is really illogical because the military budget is a tiny fraction of our overall spending. And when people talk about cutting even, let's say, 10% or 20% from the military budget, cutting $50 or $100 billion a year, that's still a drop in the bucket compared to fiscal debts that are over, you know, $1.5 trillion. And so the thing is, it's relatively easy to target defense because it means you don't have to target things like entitlements, which are politically much more difficult to go after. But, of course, it's entitlement spending that drives these fiscal deficits, much more than the defense budget. So we can afford to continue to have the foreign policy we've had unless we choose not to, in which case, as we talked about earlier in the hour, that is when you'd start to sort of will yourself into decline.
Robert Kagan is with us. His new book is called The World America Made. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Remember, you can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go next on the phones to Bedford, where we find Brian. Hello, Brian.
Hello. Sort of a comment question for our guest. My comment is, with all this policing that we're doing, it's much like child rearing. We're not letting other countries so much come into their own and solve their own disputes in some ways. Some of it is very much needed, Syria, Libya, but sometimes I don't think it's as needed. My question is, do you think it would be better off if we were to go to George Washington's farewell address, where he was very much saying, stay out of everybody else's business? What do you think about that?
Well, it's an interesting, people raise that all the time, and George Washington's farewell address is constantly being brought up. If I may be so bad as to refer you to another book of mine called Dangerous Nation, where it's a history of American foreign policy that looks at the farewell address. The interesting thing about George Washington's farewell address is it's widely misunderstood, in my view. His real admonition to the American people was, bide your time, keep your head down, at these moments when we're weak, because in a few decades we'll be strong and able to be the kind of world power that we are destined to be. I mean, George Washington was not saying that Americans should never get involved in the rest of the world ever, just when they were weak. But the answer to the question from a policy point of view today is, I think we've had some evidence, and we've witnessed what happens when the United States says, let's let the rest of the world take care of its problems. The first half of the 20th century, we tried to stay out of affairs in Europe. They had the worst global war in history. The United States came in at the end to try to bring peace. And then the American people, a majority at least, decided to pull back out and let the Europeans solve the problem themselves. And the result was what we saw, the rise of Mussolini, the rise of Hitler, World War II, and an even bigger catastrophe. And I think the lesson that was learned, it may be an unpleasant lesson, but I think nevertheless it was the lesson learned after World War II, was the United States can't afford to let the rest of the world work out all its problems, because eventually those problems come home to us. And I think, you know, as one of the previous callers mentioned, the attack of September 11th. I mean, if one thing we learned there was a country that Americans don't even think twice about, that's a mess. We all know who even would imagine we would send troops to Afghanistan. But the collapse of Afghanistan ultimately came back to bite the United States very severely. So I think we can't afford to retreat and let the rest of the world deal with its own problems.
Robert Kagan is my guest this hour. He's senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a columnist for The Washington Post. We're talking this hour about his new book, The World America Made. If you'd like to be part of this, you can give us a call. We have phone lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Robert Kagan, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of the new book, The World America Made. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Bob, I would think even the most interventionist among us would agree that throughout the course of recent history, the past six decades, the United States has made some major mistakes, particularly with regard to certain instances where we were trying to effect regime change. What do we need to do to ensure that we are appropriately and effectively applying our power?
Well, the first answer is we're never going to be perfectly applying our power. It's a nation of human beings subject to human mistakes. And, you know, I think that's, in a way, one of the toughest things to realize is that there's no escape from wielding power, and yet we can be sure that we're not always going to wield power effectively. I would say, you know, the best advice is to try to learn from the past. We do have a way. People always accuse Americans of not remembering history, but we do have a way of forgetting that we've been in these situations before. I'm always struck every time there's an intervention that people sort of think, well, this is the last time we're ever going to do this. And one thing I point out in our book, in my book, is that, you know, we don't even have the institutions in our government for dealing with issues like how do you, you know, help rebuild a country after you've intervened. We don't have, you know, the British, and I'm not saying we should, you know, try to copy the British Empire. The British had a colonial office. They had people who were, trained to deal with these situations. We always approach them in a way as if it's the first time we've ever done it. And that's partly because we think we're never going to do it again, but of course we constantly do. So some of it is just learning from history, and some of it is wisdom. There's no substitute for wisdom for deciding when force is appropriate, when it's not appropriate, and how to use it effectively. There's just no substitute for trying to think as clearly as one can.
Do we have a moral or ethical obligation to use our power to create a sort of level global playing field, or is it reasonable that in many cases the United States will, as it acts internationally, create an advantage for itself?
Well, I'm not interested in creating a level playing field of power.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should try to create as much of a level playing field in terms of economics as possible. And I think, you know, one of the remarkable qualities of the world order that the United States has dominated has been the rise of many, many millions, in fact, billions of people out of poverty. I mean, if you look at the period from 1950 until recently, global GDP growth has been around 4% a year, which is four times higher than it's ever been through human history, and most of that growth has occurred outside the transatlantic area, outside the United States, and outside of Europe. So this world order that the United States has supported has in fact enriched peoples from China to Brazil to India to Turkey and elsewhere, and I think that's important to keep in mind. When it comes to power and military power in particular, I don't think a level playing field is in anyone's interest. I think the dominance of the United States has basically been good for the world.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Before we go back to the phones, I want to ask you about this, Bob. Would scholars and analysts and logical thinkers in those places that you've just mentioned that have benefited in terms of growth of GDP, would they agree that it is the U.S. that made this happen? How do we know that we have a truly global and objective perspective on this?
Well, I myself am not saying that we made it happen by ourselves. We created the conditions in which others could make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no question that China's economic growth is due to the hard work of the Chinese people and to decisions made by Chinese leaders, and the same is true of Brazil and Turkey and India and others. What the United States has done has been to provide a global economic system in which these countries can grow and flourish, and I think that is something that you can't deny, that the fact that there has been a fairly stable, if nevertheless, you know, often troubled economic system which allows nations to trade and export, this has made it possible for these nations to do it, but then they have done it themselves. But the United States' role, I think, has been critical.
Next on the phones, we have Brian in Dallas. Hi, Brian.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I was wondering, since the U.S. has this identity as a Christian nation, even though that can be disputed, I was wondering how religion comes into play as far as world power and when governments interact with each other, such as the U.S. interacting with a avidly secular, you know, Chinese government or the Indian government, or any other, you know, country that has a different or same religious majority, I guess.
Well, that's an interesting question. I think I would say the most obvious example of that is American dealings in the Islamic world, because that's where there's the most tension. I don't think the Chinese are particularly troubled or take as a very big issue the fact that the United States is a Christian nation. I don't think India does either. But in the Muslim world, it does matter more. I mean, there are two things that I would say about that. It's an excellent question. One is that The United States has been more about spreading the religion of the Declaration of Independence than it has been about spreading its own particular religion. For one thing, there is no, even though the majority of Americans are Christian, there's no established Christian church in the United States. And most of what the United States has been supporting around the world are the sort of, universal principles of the Declaration, which are not particularly confined to Christianity. That's one point. But even where there has been this kind of religious, where you might expect a religious clash, I am struck to the degree to which today and in the case of Syria and a while back in the case of Libya, you see Islamic countries asking the United States to use force to help other Islamic peoples, whether they're in Libya or in Syria or elsewhere. To me, that means that religion is not ultimately determinative and that the issue of freedom and individual rights is still more powerful.
U.S. presidents, Bob, for a long time now have been openly committed to trying to help effect Arab-Israeli peace. I mean, some would say we have been ineffective. Would things be worse had we not taken the role we have?
Well, I don't know. That kind of depends on, it depends on when you want to start. I mean, I'm sure if in the Arab world people would say the United States began all this by supporting the creation of the State of Israel
right.
in 1948, and then, the United States has been attempting to deal with the crisis that set off in the region ever since. I don't know, so therefore it's hard to say what it would have looked like without us, since we were so integral in the foundation of the problem. But one of the things I do think it is worth noting, because sometimes people say, look how the United States can't even solve the Middle East peace process. It's a sign of our growing weakness and our decline. But as you're noting, I mean, we haven't been able to solve this problem since 1948, so there's nothing new in that.
We have an email here from Audrey. It's an interesting question. She asks, can you talk about the role of the education system in the U.S. and to what degree it's allowed or perhaps hindered the United States to be a world leader?
Well, there's a lot of attention paid to that, and I think rightly so, because if we are moving, as we certainly are, moving into an information age and a networking age, then education is obviously a critical element of that. And there are certainly, no one can doubt, there are many ways in which our educational system falls short. I tend to look at the fact that it's still the case that the world's greatest universities are all in the United States, that everyone in the world is trying to get into our universities. And there are certainly areas of the United States, I happen to live in one in Northern Virginia, where I can't imagine the standards being any higher in math and science and in other areas. So the biggest problem I think we have is a kind of divided system where some Americans are getting an outstanding education and others aren't, and that is something that needs fixing. And I agree with the emailer and others who've argued that if the United States is going to continue to compete in this world, we will have to improve our educational establishment.
An email here from Anne in Dallas asks if you would address the role of ongoing U.S. aid programs as public policy.
Well, I think they're important, and I think one of the great tragedies of recent years has been the assault on our aid programs. I wouldn't say that they always succeed in their objectives. There are many ways in which they also need to be fixed, but I think that the United States benefits tremendously from what is really quite an insubstantial sum of money that is spent on aid programs, both because for humanitarian purposes, but also for political purposes. I think that it's in our interest to help nations develop, and insofar as our aid does that, we are serving our interests.
Do you perceive, there is the Ron Paul campaign right now that is highly isolationist in a lot of the ways that it looks at America's role in the world. Do you think we are in a more isolationist period of time than we have been in recent history?
I really don't. I think that obviously there is that percentage of the voting public. And by the way, I'm not sure everyone who votes for Ron Paul is voting for his foreign policy as opposed to other elements of his program.
Sure.
But I'm not overwhelmed by the isolationist sentiment in the country yet. But even if you look at Ron Paul, who's the best barometer we have, he's probably going to win not a single state in this election cycle. He can get his 10 or 15%. But the main candidates, all of them, whether it has, and I could go through every single one of them, from Michelle Bachmann to Rick Perry those who've fallen by the wayside, to now Romney and Santorum and Newt Gingrich. They are all internationalists who basically are trying to wear the mantle of Ronald Reagan. And certainly Obama's not an isolationist, and I don't think that leading Democrats are isolationists. So we're always worrying that the United States is about to move into some isolationist phase, and yet it's remarkable how it never happens.
Do you feel like in terms of predicting the decline of America, both parties in some ways mischaracterize the state we're in and where we're going?
Well, you know, election seasons, I would say election seasons and election seasons during recessions are not the best time to find out what is a really accurate read on where we are.
Yeah.
We all have a opposition parties want to say that the things are going bad. Generally, the person in the White House doesn't want to say that, which is why I think it was, you know, interesting that President Obama in a State of the Union said people who think we're in decline don't know what they're talking about. But my view is, let us get out of this recession and then reassess, because it's just a time when we have been very unsure of ourselves, and understandably so. But at some point, we will pull out of this recession, and that's a better time to make an assessment of where we stand in the world.
Well, we mentioned earlier the president is familiar with your work. You've been an advisor to Mitt Romney. I wonder, though, if you find the election season frustrating in a way, in that these kinds of issues don't boil down well to campaign trail sound bites and snippets of stump speeches.
Of course, and it's always been that way. You know, I remember when Republicans ran on the theory that Franklin Roosevelt lied us into World War II and tricked us into World War II. I mean, foreign policy does not make the best campaign slogan most of the time, but then the campaigns are over, and fortunately, I think one thing that I would say historically is that most people, once they're elected, whatever they said during the campaign, the president takes on the responsibility for the whole nation and usually takes it on in a very sober fashion. We've seen so many elections where the president, where the candidate said, when I come into office, we're not going to do that much foreign policy. We're going to focus on the economy, only to have them focus on foreign policy, because there's no escaping it for the United States.
What is worth worrying about with regard to how we move ahead and plan for the future of the American role in the world?
Well, I would say the thing we should worry about most is our own complicity, if you could say that, with weakening our power. Our ability to play the role we've been playing depends on our willingness to play that role, which needs to be supported domestically, and it also depends to some extent on our military capacity. Nations around the world look to the United States to back them up and to provide them with a sense of security, whether it's against China in the South China Sea, whether it's against Iran in the Middle East, whether it's in the Indian Ocean or elsewhere. And so long as the United States is able to play that role, the world is going to be a more stable and safer place. But if we deprive ourselves of the capacity to play that role, then we begin to head into, I think, either a different kind of world order, which will be less attuned to our interests, or disorder, which is something that we have seen erupt in the past.
And we need to continue, I suppose, to steel ourselves for the fact that many nations of the world will rely on us for protection and yet sort of denounce our actions to the rest of the world.
Exactly. This is our lot in life, and I think we just have to be used to it. It has been this way also for a long time. And I think the other thing we need to realize is it's always going to be difficult. Wielding influence is difficult. One thing I say in the book is that foreign policy is like hitting a baseball. When you miss 70% of the time, you go to the Hall of Fame. You're just not going to succeed all the time, but that doesn't mean you don't need to keep trying.
Robert Kagan is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and columnist for The Washington Post. His newest book is called The World America Made. Bob, it's been a great discussion. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. It was a lot of fun.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. You can email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.